So this is our audience participation. Kyle Thompson has a microphone, and the way the game is going to work is I'll show a topic, so you prime your brain to say, maybe I know something about that. Then I'm going to show the question. You'll read it. Next, the first person who stand up gets a chance at taking an answer. Now, what would be ideal is if all of these questions in your mind are so simple that you go, oh, pshaw, why would Jerry even take the time to ask such a question? My suspicion is that some of them may be hard. Don't be inhibited. If you think you know the answer, stand up, because if you answer correctly, there's a prize. If incorrect, there's no embarrassment. Another person simply gets a chance at the answer. And then once the answer is identified correctly, I'll explain in detail and respond to questions. It is, after all, a continuing education session, so we'll go deeper on the answer depending on interest of the audience. So the main thing is we hope you'll stand up and answer. I tried to pick out some good prizes that people might get, and I thought, well, you know, I have a favorite author. And so I thought maybe I could get some of his books. There's two. One is an historical fiction, tells about the building of Hoover Dam. The other answers a question, and this is true, 8 true stories. How did 4 feet of plywood save the Grand Canyon? And that's really a compelling story that would surprise those of you who love to go to Lake Powell, because it was in danger. Okay, we straight? Question number one. This is going to deal with whole life insurance. So this is for all my friends when I worked at New York Life, Mass Mutual, Beneficial, with Penn Mutual. If you think you know whole life, here's the question. The cash value of a whole life paid up addition is increased by interest and dividends, and it is decreased by age-adjusted mortality and expense charges each year. Is that true or is that false? We have a standing person.
False.
Okay. Once you get the microphone, explain your answer.
It's false because whole life does not earn interest, it earns dividends.
Okay. Everybody agree with that? How many think that his explanation was correct? How many think his explanation was a little short? Yeah, okay, so the correct answer is you got the correct answer, so you win a prize. Let's hear for it. Unfortunately, your explanation wasn't entirely correct. So let's go into that and explain what I mean by that. So a whole life paid up addition is paid up. That means that one payment completely guarantees that little whole life policy for the rest of that person's life, regardless of changes to the external environment. Unlike universal life, where declining interest rates or lower index credits can place the policy in peril of lapse, in a whole life policy and a paid-up addition particularly, once declared, the cash value is guaranteed and it will equal the death benefit at age 121. It's also eligible for non-guaranteed dividends. It can be combined with the base policy annual dividend to purchase even more paid-up additions. So the correct answer is there is no explicit charge to cash value for expenses or mortality, as is the case with universal life. Now, why was your answer incomplete? The fact is that a whole life policy, including a paid-up addition, does earn interest, a guaranteed interest rate that will take the cash value from the initial amount to the face amount of the policy at age 121. So there's a guaranteed interest rate in a whole life policy. There's a non-guaranteed dividend, which is a share of the company's profits that is determined each year by the board of directors. That dividend can be paid in what? Well, let's make that a second question. So if you want to come down and get your book now, you can come down later, make your choice. The second thing we have here, Jeff, are you here, Barlowman? Yes, would you come down, please? Jeff is going to go around with a box of, these are full-size candy bars. So these are not those cheap little candy bars. These are good candy bars. So let's ask some additional questions here to see if we can dig a little deeper into this, how the whole life works. So I've given you the information you need for this answer. If a $1,000 dividend is declared by the insurance company on a whole life policy on a 35-year-old male, And if the face amount of that paid-up petition is $5,000, what will the guaranteed cash value of that paid-up petition be at age 121? We have Ken, first up.
$5,000.
Ken, you get a candy bar of your choice. How could it get better than that? In a UL policy, if I take cash surrenders from the policy, let's suppose I'm 65 and I start taking out money, I can place that policy in peril of lapse, can't I? Because if mortality charges go up or if interest rates fall, I may consume the cash value of that policy before I reach my own personal mortality maturity date. If I cash out all of my whole life additions in a whole life policy, do I put the base policy in danger? Will the base policy lapse because I've cashed out paid-up additions?
No.
Okay, explain your answer.
Paid-up additions are going to be initial insurance and reduce the base.
Very good. So, candy bar, Jeff? So the correct answer is no. It's like you have two separate buckets of money. For a practical purpose, whole life is like the most resilient boxer you can get. You can hit it, you can knock him to the floor, you can shake him, you can put him through. Well, let's see, with New York Life, Penn Mutual, Mass Mutual, you can go through the Civil War, you can go through the Mexican-American War, you can go through World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, Iraq. You can go through the Great Depression, the Great Recession. No matter what you hit a whole life policy with, it just gets up, doesn't it? And it just gets going. One of my very favorite things is I read a bumper sticker years ago. It said, "How'd you do in the market today? Your whole life went up." Because mathematically, that's all that can happen, isn't it? It can just go up. So you have a bucket of money that's a base policy. You have a second bucket of money that's a whole life addition or paid-up additions. You can cash out those paid-up additions with no effect on the base policy. So a great policy. Okay, very good. Well, we got good answers, so let's move on to question number two. This is for the people in the room who sell disability income insurance. To reduce the out-of-pocket premium on casualty insurance, such as car or homeowners, you can do two things. You can increase the deductible, or you can reduce the coverage limits. To reduce the out-of-pocket premium on a disability income replacement policy, you can adjust the Mark Barlidge was first. You are really close, Greg, but just not quite there. Mark's right here. Okay, what can you increase or what can you adjust?
You can adjust the elimination period.
Okay.
Or the benefit period.
And I called it the waiting period instead of the benefit period, but Mark is correct. So you get your choice. Oh, thank you, Kyle. That's nice. So you can increase the waiting period. That's how long I go before the disability policy starts to pay me an income. The second thing I can do is I can decrease the benefit period, which means I might have a disability policy that pays for 1 year's worth of disability, 2 years, 5 years, to age 65, or lifetime. So the longer the benefit period, the more risk is falling on the insurance company. If I shorten that period, obviously I can bring my premium down. Okay, here's our bonus question. This is a candy bar question. Of the two, which has the greater increased risk to the client? Which one poses the greatest risk? Back there.
The benefit period.
Okay, so explain your answer.
All right, so the waiting period typically is only, the longest waiting period might be 6 months or so. So you might go 6 months without coverage, or 6 months that you're waiting for the policy to pay out. But the benefit period, if it's too short, and you have a long-term disability that's decades long, then you've gone decades without receiving payments instead of months.
Very good. Perfect answer, Jeff, if you would. That was great. So here's what was said. Suppose that I'm a high-income individual, a doctor, and I purchase $10,000 worth of monthly replacement income. I go with a 30-day waiting period or a 6-month waiting period, 180 days. The difference between 1 month and 6 months is $50,000. the difference between a five-year benefit and a 2-age 65 benefit may be 30 years times $120,000 a year, $3.2 million. So just as with car insurance, it makes sense to increase the deductible. If you want to adjust the premium on a disability policy, it makes sense to increase the waiting period. Try to hold on to as long a benefit term as you can. Everyone understand that? I have to tell you very quickly about a conversation I had. I didn't do it through LinkedIn. Maybe I did, now that I think about it. But I hooked up with a friend that I'd known from sixth grade. He is the president of an engineering company down in Phoenix, Arizona. I travel there for Cambridge periodically, and so I said, let's have lunch. And I had forgotten that his dad had been working, and he'd been on a roof. He fell from the roof, was impaled on a tree, and he was crippled for the rest of his life. And this man talked to me, so he's very successful financially, my friend, but he talked about how the family suffered because of the loss of income. He said the only thing that saved us, he had been working for the LDS Church, is that they had a disability income replacement policy that covered our rent, our food, our utilities. He said, and that was the only thing that gave my dad a sense of dignity. And this is a tough guy. He wept as he told me this story. So this is one of the most important questions on the page. Okay, question number three, long-term care. Prime your brain. Are you a long-term care person? Long-term care insurance helps offset the cost of custodial or home care for people with a chronic illness. The way you define a chronic illness is that insurers must qualify for benefits based on the inability to complete at least two of the six activities of daily living without substantial outside assistance. So this is really a cool trigger. It says there are certain things we do every day in order to be independent and to care for ourselves from a physical point of view. And once we need assistance with that, we can get money from an insurance company to help pay for those costs. Name at least four of the six ADLs right here. Wait for the mic if you would, because there's lots of people behind you. Here it comes.
Okay, so eating.
Okay, that's correct. Yes, if we can't eat without help.
Bathing,
the ability to keep ourselves clean.
Transferring,
that's getting in and out of chairs, in and out of bed.
And
you're doing really good.
One more. let's see.
Somebody help him out.
No, just a minute.
Wait, he's got it.
I do these every day. Toileting?
Toileting, yay, we got four of them. Want to keep going? Okay, here we go. These are the six activities of daily living. The ability to bathe or shower, the ability to maintain continence, the ability to dress ourselves. Some of the things that can happen as people get older and as their fingers get stiff from arthritis, I've got a hip that seems to be acting up, is you can use Velcro instead of buttons. So there's a lot of things that can help people, but eventually you may need help. Eating, being able to get on and off the toilet without help, and being able to get in and out of bed. Note, participants may also qualify if suffering from a severe cognitive impairment. They might be able to do all of those things, but they don't know where they are or what's happening. So here's our bonus question. What is the taxation of long-term care insurance? Jan Christensen. To the person receiving it, it is tax-free, and that's a correct answer. So candy bar to Jan. Now, there is a safe harbor limit because today many life insurance policies have chronic illness acceleration benefit riders that can accelerate the tax-free death benefit to help pay for the cost of long-term care. To me, that creates a wonderful additional reason for people to buy life insurance. For those of you who have ever considered selling a single premium modified endowment policy, as you know from a MEC policy, you take distributions of gain first and it's taxable, and only then can you take tax-free distribution of basis. If you take a loan from a MEC, Warren, what's the taxation? Taxable to the extent of gain, it increases basis, but here's the secret. If the policy has a chronic illness acceleration benefit rider, the acceleration of the death benefit is tax-free, even from a modified endowment contract. So that's a great opportunity for those of you who have access to that type of policy. Question number four, we're moving into the space where I like to work now, executive benefits. Which of the following two concepts are not currently deductible to the employer? So I wrestle with this question. It may be easier for you to think which are deductible, and then it's the other two. But we're looking for which are not. A Section 162 executive bonus plan, a split dollar policy that is owned by the employer, that's often called an economic benefit regime split dollar, a restricted property trust, and deferred compensation plans. Okay, who's gonna stand? Ooh, right here, brave man, he was first. Wait for the mic.
I know one of them is the deferred compensation plans.
Well, okay, but the question is two.
Right, the second one I'd have to say would be the split dollar policy that's owned by the employer.
How many think he's correct? How many think he's incorrect? How many have no idea? Okay, you are correct. Those are the two. So that's really good. Now, this is one of those where, you know, we all promote our workshops for the afternoon. I want you to go wherever it makes the most sense for you. But these are the three topics I'll be talking about this afternoon in detail. I won't talk too much about the restricted property trust, but endorsement split dollar, that's a situation where an employer buys a policy on the life of a key employee, the employer owns the cash value, and the employer owns a portion of the death benefit. Usually it includes the cash value, maybe some amount retained for key person coverage, and the employer endorses the excess death benefit to the family of the covered employee. And the reason we do that is that I can put all sorts of restrictions on when the employee may receive the cash value. So I can say, as long as you're employed by me, you get free life insurance, and we have an asset on the books. Warren, if you stay till I'm age 60, until you're age 60, we will bonus a policy to you, and it'll be yours. But if you leave before 60, you forfeit all interest in the policy. As the employer, we get to keep the cash value. Most companies have an exchange privilege where you can actually move that policy onto the life of another employee and make that an executive bonus or an executive benefit for them. Deferred compensation plans can either be funded by employer money or employee money. This is oftentimes called a 401k overlay plan. So, as you all know, if I participate in a 401k, I can put $14,500 of my own money into it, up to 100% of salary. My employer can match, and all of that is deductible to the employer, but it's not reportable as income to me. I don't pay any tax on the money that's in the 401k account until I take withdrawals, presumably after age 60, and then they're taxable. Well, that works really good for someone making $50,000 to $100,000 a year, but if you have a highly compensated employee who's making $200,000 or $300,000 a year, how can they save enough money using that format, given that a 401k is capped at $55,000 total annual contribution? The way is that if the employer is willing to postpone their deduction, they can create a plan for key executives that to the executive feels exactly like a 401k. The employer creates an account. So when I was a beneficial life, I participated in a deferred comp plan. I put all my bonus money into it. Beneficial owns that in an SEI account that belongs to beneficial. They will start paying that to me at age 65. They got no deduction on the money that they could have deducted had they paid it to me. I didn't pay any tax on it. When they take money from that account, they'll receive that generally tax-free because they've already paid tax, and they'll make a tax-deductible payment to me in retirement. Great plan. I think it's really terrific. Executive bonus plans and restricted property trusts are currently deductible to the employer. Here's your bonus question. What is the risk of covering non-executive or highly compensated employees in these plans? What if I'm an employer and the janitor started with me on day one, he's never had the, you know, that's the job that's best suited to him, and I think I want to cover Joe. Is there a risk to including Joe in this type of plan? Right here, Greg. Just wait a second, Kyle will bring you the mic, because because you have this wonderfully deep voice, Greg, that is impossible for me to hear even with my hearing aids. So there you go.
Well, two that I can think of. First of all, you can subject to the plan to ERISA requirements by including them. Second, if that's the only person that you include, you could be subject to discrimination by not making it available to other non-highly compensated people.
Greg answered that question perfectly. That's exactly the risk of including non-highly compensated employees in an executive benefit plan, is that all of a sudden ERISA, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, rushes in and says, well, if you're going to do this for even one rank and file person, you got to do it for all of them. And then all of a sudden you've created your costs much higher. Okay, I thought that was fun. You might not. Now, for those of us in the room who do not think that Index Universal Life is evil, and I count myself as one of those, here we go. What percentage of the cash value of an Index Universal Life is invested in the S&P 500 or other market index? Right there. Wait for the mic. Here it comes. I picked the most athletic guy I know to carry the mic. Oh, wait. I got to put it out here so the rest have a choice to choose from. So now you get to answer 1, 2, 3, or 4.
How about 2?
2. You say 0, but I thought the total return of an index policy is based on changes in the S&P 500. How could there be 0 money in the S&P?
Well, it's technically considered a...
Okay, he's correct, folks. Okay. He gave the right answer. And I'm prepared to answer it in detail, but...
Okay.
So do you want to go ahead, or...?
Yeah, really none of it's ever invested there. It's funded with options, you know, and other tools, but none of the money's technically ever put into the stock market or the S&P 500.
It is neither technically nor in reality ever put into it. Where does it go? Well, it turns out that 0% of the money is invested in the S&P 500 or their market index. Rather, it's invested in the cash value of an index UL is invested in the general account of the insurance company, the very same account that guarantees the cash values of a whole life policy. So if I have a universal life policy with a $100,000 cash value, all $100,000 of that sitting safely in the general account of Penn Mutual or Minnesota Mutual or PacLife, 100% is in the general account, the same as the cash value of a whole life policy. So how do we get a return that's based on the S&P 500? What happens is the insurance company earns interest on that $100,000, doesn't it? MassMutual, I think, is at a 7% dividend as a gross crediting rate. Penn Mutual's at 6.3. Northwestern's at 6. Now, Mass may have different expenses so that, you know, once we're competing against each other, from that 6% or to 7% that the insurance company earns, they take some for spread. That's what it takes to run the company. And they, in a whole life, they credit a guaranteed credit to the cash value and pay a dividend. In an index policy, they make a credit to the cash value, some are 0, some are 1. With the excess, they go out and buy an option. What is an option? Well, there's somebody who owns the S&P 500 who thinks the market's going to go down next year. And they think that it's going to suck because they're not going to get any return on their $100,000. We think that it's going to go up. So we go to them and say, what if we paid you some money, 4% of $100,000, $4,000, and here's the deal. If a year from today the stock market is up, you have to give us 100% of the increase up to a cap at the company I represent. It's currently 11%. But if it's down, you're going to keep the 4,000. Now, from the person who sells the option, can you see that they've just guaranteed a return on their money of 4%? So they're happy no matter what happens. But if a year from now the S&P is up 20, they have to write a check to the insurance company for $11,000, which gets passed through to the owner of the company. If the market's down next year, they keep their 4. All that happens in the UL policy is the cash value still sitting there in the general account. So that's how an index product works. Historically, they've averaged in the period from 2000 to 2010, where the market was up and down, that's one of the few periods in history where the market was at the same place it was 10 years as it was 10 years earlier, And in an index policy, it averaged a 6.5% credit to cash value during that period of time. Because all you want with an index UL is volatility. You want it to go up and capture the high and not capture the loss. Okay, so that's pretty detailed. So the way that I think that an index policy is successfully sold is when you maximum fund it for a given face amount. Go to the MEC limit, stuff as much money into that policy as you can, and then you've got a pretty resilient beast. Okay, let's move on. I want to get to more questions. John's looking at his clock watch wherever John is, and Bart's nervous for me. Will he end on time? I will. Disability. What is the taxation to the employer and the employee of both premiums paid and benefits received if the employer establishes a qualified sick pay plan? Okay. Are you standing there? Kyle is not going to answer the question. Anybody ever hear of a qualified sick pay plan? We have a participant. You're at the back. Go ahead and shout it out.
The answer is going to be it's tax deductible to the employer.
Yes.
Taxable to the participant. Depends on who's paying the bills.
Maybe you want to consider that second one. Okay, you're going to get a participation prize because you're a very brave man. Here's one of the best things in the tax code. So up with the books. A qualified sick pay plan is a document that can be drafted by employers that is discriminatory. So you can pick and choose who the employees are. And essentially what it says is it is in our interest to see that our employees have income replacement in the event of a disability. Because if we take care of that problem for our employees, they tend to be more productive because they don't have to worry about it and they don't have to pay for it. With a qualified sick pay plan, the premiums are deductible to the employer. They are not reportable to the employee, and the benefits are tax-free to the employee. This is a home run in the taxation world. It's the only place that you get a deduction with no income and a tax-free benefit, and it's an awesome thing to do, and very few people do it. Very few people will, and all that has to happen is you got to draft the document and start paying the premiums. So that was really good, huh? So we ought to do that for people. Let's see if I have a follow-up question for this one. Oh, I do. I answered it. So let's see if you heard what I said. If I establish a qualified sick pay plan, do I have to cover everybody? No. Quack! Okay, I wish I had a candy bar for everybody. You can discriminate. You can discriminate to owners, to highly compensated. You probably want to keep it in the highly compensated group, but you can pick JR, but you don't have to pick Jeff. You can include Kyle, but you don't have to cover Corey. Completely discriminatory. Okay, now we're going to get to the good stuff, and I got 5 minutes. Taxation of life insurance.
True.
Yes. Okay, fine. The death benefit of a life insurance policy excluded from taxable income for income tax purposes. One of the best benefits we got. Name an action that can cause the death benefit in excess of premiums paid to be subject to ordinary income taxes. Back here. Wait. You got a mic coming. He's right there. Be patient.
Violating 101J regarding notice and consent. For employer on life insurance.
Damn. That's exactly right. It is not the answer that I was looking for. You get a book. This is good. Okay, is somebody name something else that can cause it to be? Dwayne Tony at the back. Okay, sale of the policy. Can you go just a little deeper? There's a phrase in the code that says a transfer for value. I think you get a candy bar for that, Dwayne, okay? So here's what it is. There's something called the transfer for value rule. It says if a client transfers ownership of a policy to another party for valuable consideration, that could be cash, it could be the exchange of a policy I own on Warren's life for a policy that Warren owns on my life, the death benefit becomes taxable, unless it qualifies for one of the four exceptions to the transfer for value rule. Note, a gift of the policy is not subject to death benefit, does not subject the death benefit to taxes because there's no value. It's a gift. Okay, so since we know now that there is such a thing as a transfer for value rule, and we know that there are four exceptions to the transfer for value rule, who wants to name three of the four exceptions? Okay. Oh, wait a minute. You talked about 101J. No, it's okay. Anybody else? Okay, fine. Candy bar. Oh, I see. Well, there you go. Fine, I'll keep my book. Do you want to answer it? Okay, Mike. Come on, Mr. Mike.
I'm hurrying.
Yeah.
A transfer to the insured, a transfer to a partnership in which the insured is a partner. You have the carryover basis exception and a transfer to a corporation in which the insured is an officer.
Oh, girl. I don't know who you are, but I want to hug you.
Come to my afternoon session.
Yeah, this is great. So the government said there are cases where if you have an existing policy, you may want to exchange it to someone else, and we think that it's okay. So if the last transfer, even if it had failed four or five previous transfers, if the last transfer is to the insured person, death benefit is tax-free. If I'm in a partnership, and in order to fund a cross-purchase buy-sell agreement, I transfer my policy to Roy Allen, in Roy's hands, the death benefit will be tax-free. If Roy and Mark Barlage and I are in a partnership, we can transfer it to the partnership and it remains tax-free. Or if we're the owners of a corporation, we can do it. Now, here's the problem with the transfer for value rule. Whoever drafted the legislation 50 years ago forgot to say, or a transfer to a stockholder. So if Chad Parker and I are owners of an S corporation, and I say, Chad, I want to do a cross-purchase buy-sell agreement, and we say, well, let's exchange policies, it is not an exception to the rule, and in Chad's hand, the death benefit will be subject to income tax. It's going to be a 45% tax in the state of Utah. $1 million policy, that was a $450,000 mistake. Now, there are remedies for that, but we're not going to talk about them here. So understand that that's really important. Also note that when you sell a policy on the secondary market, that in the hands of the investors who buy that policy, that is a failed transfer for value, it will be subject to tax. Okay, John, I think I'm out of time, right? Okay. You guys don't get to learn about life insurance and a pension other than know that you can put 25% of the annual contribution into an index universal life or 49% into a whole life. And the big secret that most people don't know is that if the money's been held in an index or in a pension plan for more than 2 years, you can put an unlimited amount of that money into a pension plan. So for those of you who sell single premium whole life that typically has a 4-5% return, you can take all that accumulated pension money and use it to get a fixed account that's the best in the industry. You put it into a whole life insurance policy. It can go into a UL, but for people who are looking for safety, whole life might be the answer. Well, I hope this has been fun. I hope it's been informative. And thank you for everyone who participated. We will turn it back to Bart.